a baby and rock them, it's not that they just fall asleep. They melt. And you can feel them relax and be non-stressed and be at their most, you know, profoundly comforted.
No, but exactly. I think that that's like, it's so helpful and to recognize like this is something that you could continue to carry through.
We do these little things that make them feel seen in the world. Probably do something like this. Yummy, yummy, yummy. Look what's so delicious. 5 or 6 hours of this closeness and rocking leads to improved brain development for the children compared to the prematures who didn't have that type of experience. And tell you one other little fun, little easy thing to do works 1,000% of the time.
What are you going to say? Are we going to talk about gossiping? Are we going to talk about us?
Welcome back to Sensory Play Reimagined, a podcast exploring how sensory play can help unlock your child's development and well-being potential. I'm Rachel Rothman. I'm your host. I'm a toy expert and a mom of three. And today we have the most fantastic guest with us, and I am grateful to call him a friend. We have Dr. Harvey Karp. He needs no introduction. He is, you know, the country's pediatrician. And again, we are just so thrilled to have you. And if you maybe want to give like a quick hit on who you are and what you are, for somebody who may be living under a rock or has been pregnant for the last 9 months, I'm sure they've been reading your books. But if you want to give just like a quick background on who you are and, you know, what you do, I think that would be great.
Yeah, sure. So I'm a pediatrician and child developmentalist. Worked for almost 30 years in the office. So I was the corner doc that a lot of families would bring their kids to. And through that kind of observed some things about children that hadn't really been brought into our thinking or our awareness. So I wrote a book about 25 years ago, called The Happiest Baby on the Block, which it was really explaining about a concept called the fourth trimester, that babies are really not ready for the world when they're first born, and then ways to really kind of new ideas on how to calm babies and promote sleep to give parents extra tools. And then wrote a book called The Happiest Toddler on the Block, which tried to kind of give the kind of the inside secrets that pediatricians and preschool teachers know about how to wrangle little kids and get them to be patient and cooperative and stuff like that. And so that was a teaching for a long time. And then about 8 years ago, my wife and I started a company where we created a baby bed called Snoo, which is a responsive kind of smart bassinet that's used to improve sleep and reduce crying. And it's the first FDA de novo authorized device to keep babies safely on the back, because one of our big goals is to reduce the risk of infant death. We're hoping to reduce postpartum depression and really kind of try to help put a Band-Aid on a huge cultural problem that we have in the United States, which is the loss of the extended family. The nuclear family that most of us think is the normal family is really couldn't be more abnormal from a history of humanity point of view. So other than that, not much, just hanging out.
I have to pause to everybody knows this. If anyone's listening, I'm sure they know who you are and what you've done. But I will say you were the only book. Like, I read one book through my entire pregnancy and it was yours. And I felt like armed and ready to take on parenthood thanks to it. I religiously studied the 5 S's. Those 5 S's got me through that fourth trimester. So I bow down to you. I'm
going to actually tell you, don't let my publisher know this, but the book is a fine book and it's interesting. It's got anthropology. But when parents ask me what I recommend watching. There's a 30-minute video that my wife
did. I did that too.
But I'm telling you, it's kind of like learning how to tie your shoelaces. If you've never seen someone do it, it's kind of like, how do these laces go? But once you know how to do it, you're like looking for crying babies. It's like, can I help you? You know, I mean, people.
That's literally me. I feel empowered. I could swallow you. I'm going to shush you. I'm going to get you down. And it's like almost a game to try to get, you know, to get them quiet in as quick a time as possible. So, yes, I think the entire.
Set the stopwatch. Ready, set, go.
Literally, I went, my brother and sister-in-law just had a baby and I was like, oh, hand me the baby, you know, like the second I got it, you know, and you bounce right back into it. So yes, and thank you for sharing that. Always looking for tips and tricks for particularly new parents. You know, I've been through the ringer three times, but that first time when you just have no idea to expect the unexpected. I remember I was grateful enough to have you kind of on speed dialing in my corner, sending you notes, you know, throughout the entire thing. So for everyone who, you know, may not have that level of access to you, watch the 30 minutes. I had Jesse, my husband, obviously watch it. And, you know, again, I think any tools you have to empower parents, particularly when they're sleep deprived, when there's a host of emotions, all these different things, you know, what a blessing you have provided for families. And then, you know, you get to that next stage. And again, you so thoughtfully, you know, I appreciated understanding the context of the why. And I thought that for me, the understanding of why they were acting in a way that they were and what I could do to kind of offset those, you know, when the cries or tantrums later on and all those different things. For me, that was really helpful. But like for my husband, he's just like, I want to be able to stop this. You know, I want to be able to, you know, figure out what I can do and problem solve in that moment. So it was incredibly helpful.
And, you know, it's fun. I probably have more guys come up to me, high five, and you're the dude on the video or something like that, because men, I mean, we all know men are pretty terrible at breastfeeding, but we're very, very good at baby calming. And our arms are longer and stronger, and kind of like we look at swaddling as an engineering task. You know, we're going to get it done. You know, like you want to flip a quarter off and see that it's done snugly and whatnot. But it really gives men that the permission and the skills. And of course, women are great at the five S's as well. But men really feel ownership of it, which is great, because that really helps to build out the partnership. We're not just the fifth wheel. But if I could just say one thing about this, just to kind of broaden, fill this out a little bit, because I think people don't fully have the concept organized in their minds right. But if you think about taking care of a baby, kind of as a three-legged stool, there are three skills that are really the key primary skills that if you've got them nailed, you're going to have a great time. You're going to be bragging to your friends how easy it was. And if you fail at any one of the three, the stool's going to fall over. And so the first one is feeding babies. And, you know, for 80 years, there's been tons of information, you know, breastfeeding, bottle feeding, La Leche League, lactation consultants, books, magazines. I mean, we've had lots and lots of great, great information and more support for women. Because it's challenging, especially breastfeeding. It's, you know, a lot of times it's super easy. A lot of times it's you know, takes some help on the baby side or the mother's side. But the other two legs are reducing crying or calming the baby and improving sleep. And for the most part, over the last 80 years, we've miseducated parents. And we've told them, you know what, babies have to wake up a lot. You know, you're going to have to wait 4, 5, 6 months before, you know, they're sleeping well. Oh my God, some babies cry sometimes for hours. We call it colic. Don't really know what colic is, but you know, it can be really hard. But by 4 months, 5 months, it'll be gone. So just suck it up and deal with it. And then when parents are so desperate that they're cracking into pieces and they come to the pediatrician and they say, I can't do this anymore, then we whisper a secret to them. And we say, well, you know, there is one magic thing that will immediately reduce crying and increase sleep. Drive them all night in the car. And lo and behold, 98% of babies, if you drive them all night in the car, they're going to cry less and they're going to sleep more. And so what that means is that we doctors have kind of been miseducating people, that indeed we can be much more successful with those other two legs of the stool if we give babies these rhythms that they had in the womb, because it turns out the womb is like a symphony of sensations. It's the sound is louder than a vacuum cleaner, inside there, this rumbly blood flow. They're constantly held. And every time you breathe and every time you walk, you're you know, kind of jiggling your baby. And so women will often say that my baby starts kicking when I go to bed at night. Why is that? Well, it's because they don't have those rhythms anymore. And if you bop your belly back and forth like that, you actually can put your fetus back to sleep. So anyway, the key point here is that to really have a great successful experience with a little baby, it's good to learn how to feed. And then it's also good to learn these five S's techniques for calming babies. And then ultimately, and that's why we came out with Snoo, how do you give your baby the womb experience all night long? And when you're cooking dinner and when you're taking a shower and when you're with your three-year-old, how do you give your baby this help? Because you should have five nannies, right? You should have your grandmother, your aunt, your older sister living in the duplex above you or in the neighborhood around you. Up until 80 years ago, that's what everyone had. And so we're struggling with this. And a lot of parents think I shouldn't even have help because a normal mom and dad do this all by themselves. But actually, that's not the way human beings raise children. It is with help. So anyway, I'm dumping all this out because someone may have to take their toddler to the potty or something and not see the whole podcast. So I wanted to
I think it's laying also the groundwork for understanding that like all of these sensory elements are happening from the womb when they come out, and kind of their interactions and responses to it are one, innate and primal. And, you know, what are the different things that we could be doing to help it? But I also love that, like, you always give, it makes me feel better about it, because it's like we live in a society that is so warped from what was like what our bodies were designed to do and how we were designed to be supported. You know, now we're not, you know, surrounded by this community of people. We don't have as much support. We're expected back in the office, you know, sooner. You know, I'm grateful that some things are happening there that are starting to change. But like, I had to go on a transatlantic flight 3 months postpartum while I'm breastfeeding. You know, that's challenging. That's really hard. And that's not natural. It's not natural to be that far away and to try to figure out, you know, how am I going to be able to feed my baby and all those different things. So I think just like, one, recognizing times are different now and that science and everything else is slowly catching up to it and the understanding of it and how we can support it. And again, just as like a mother myself and someone who's been through the ringer, you know, a few times, the tools and the understanding you provide is just so helpful. And it just made it like emotionally also, you know, made me feel so much better that it's like, no, I'm not supposed to be doing this alone. This is not natural to be doing alone. I need the support of other people. I should be relying on the support of other people.
Exactly. Ask for a casserole. Ask someone, yeah. You know, if someone wants to come over and visit, I mean, you know, they will feel good about having helped you, and you can be grateful and appreciative. And that really passes it all forward. So it's the time to allow yourself to be helped and not to think that I have to do everything. That's kind of why we came out with Snoo, this little responsive baby bed. So Snoo rocks and shushes babies. And when the baby cries, it responds with four different incremental levels of rocking and shushing to imitate what what your aunt would do if she came over and wanted to help you for the first 3 months or 6 months. And it also secures babies so they can accidentally flip to an unsafe position. So we've now measured, you know, you and I started talking way, way back when I was a little baby with, and Snoo was a little baby. We've now measured over 600.
Maybe my first baby kind of collided, you know.
That's right. We're all babies together. We've now measured over 650 million hours of infant sleep. So it's kind of like, you know, McDonald's hamburgers. And we've seen that, just like driving in the car, it immediately adds an hour or two to the baby's sleep. And here's the thing about sensory stimulation that I really kind of wanted to plant a seed, because this is really new information that the world of science hasn't really, we're just dabbling in right now, but it's going to be a major issue over the next 5 and 10 years. It turns out that we think it's normal to sleep in dark silence. We recommend that parents put their babies on their back in their own bassinet or crib by themselves, no soft objects around them that they could get their face mushed into. And that's kind of what's normal for babies to do for, you know, 12 or 14 hours a day during those first 6 months period. But that is incredibly abnormal for babies. It's amazing that any baby can sleep in that environment, because if you ask 1,000 babies, would you like to be in the dark silence on your back for 14 hours, or would you like to be held and rocked and shushed in my arms? I mean, we know what the babies would say. And when you hold a baby and rock them, it's not that they just fall asleep. They melt. Yeah. They just melt into you. And you can feel them relax and be non-stressed and be at their most, you know, profoundly comforted. And so here's the interesting science. About 30, 40 years ago, doctors, I believe it was Ecuador, but don't hold me to that, were having a problem because they didn't have money to buy incubators to protect premature babies. And the premature babies were dying because they couldn't be stabilized. And so they kind of came up with the idea of strapping the baby to the mother's chest and putting a big hood over the mother's head to kind of have the baby rebreathe this warm air so that there was kind of a temperature stable environment for the baby. And lo and behold, that worked as well as an incubator to keep these premature babies alive. And they called it kangaroo care. And then this process started to be picked up in other countries, even in first world countries where we have incubators. But where we started to learn that, you know, incubator is not actually the best environment. Even in the United States, holding a baby skin to skin, especially premature, like a 2-pound baby, and having them feel the rhythm of the chest and hear their mother's breathing and smell their mother's scent and feel that electric skin to skin kind of beautiful experience. Even if you do that 4 or 5 hours a day, it reduced the infant's risks so that they survive better. And now we've done brain studies of these infants 15 years later. And we can see that even 5 or 6 hours of this closeness and rocking leads to improved brain development for the children compared to the prematures who didn't have that type of experience. And so what that raises the question of is the best thing we can do for babies to put them in dark, silent sensory deprivation for 14 hours a night for the first 6 months of life? Is that really the most nurturing for infants? Or is rocking and shushing and responding to them more nurturing for their nervous system? And so what we've been looking at as far as SNU is concerned, I said we've measured 650 million hours. We know, boom, right from the beginning, we can add an hour or more to that baby's nighttime sleep. But what we didn't anticipate, and it's really quite extraordinary, is that by 3 months of age, which is when a lot of people are going back to work, right? A lot of times you got other responsibilities, and now you're kind of coming out of the cocoon of having your little baby. A normal 3-month-old gives you about a 5-hour stretch of continuous sleep. A little more, a little less, but on average, it's about 5 hours of unbroken sleep, which is when you're going to get your sleep so you can manage the next day. On average, parents say they get around 6.5 hours of sleep, which is
broken. Who are these parents?
It's broken up into little pieces, but I mentioned that number because the U.S. Highway Safety Commission says if you're getting less than 6 hours a night of sleep on just one night, not to mention chronic sleep deprivation, but just one night of under 6 hours doubles your risk of serious car accident the next day. And under 4 hours of sleep increases the risk by like 11-fold. So sleep deprivation has a real impact on parents' ability to do the jobs that we have to do. But anyway, in SNU, if the normal 3-month-old gives you about a 5-hour stretch, in SNU, with these rhythms and responsiveness, on average, it's 6.5 hours to 7 hours. That's a 40% increase in continual sleep. We never thought was possible before, but we're accelerating the baby's sleep brain regulation like 2 to 3 months earlier than we ever thought was possible. So now we want to look at cognitive development and emotional development and attentional development. Can we preset the baby's brain to a more comforted and safe environment by giving them these rhythms? And that's where it really fits in so much into the great work that you're doing by bringing up the whole concept of sensory stimulation, that it isn't, you know, just good food, which is incredibly important, and reading books, which is incredibly important, but we have to think with all of our senses.
Yeah, it's so fantastic. All right, I want to shift gears. I could sit here and talk to you about the newborn stage, the fourth trimester, but I do want to get a little bit into toddlerhood. And again, you've done so much also there that is so instrumental and important for helping support families and parents. And one of the things that I love, like again, there's so many amazing takeaways from all of your different books and your research and blogs and content that you put out. But maybe we can just first start with toddleries. If you can give everybody kind of like a quick understanding of what does toddleries mean and why does it work? And then I'll be shooting in a handful more questions from there. But if you could just first kind of tee it up for everyone and explain what is toddleries.
Sure. So for many, many years, we've talked about a concept called motheries or parentees. That's been in the medical literature for many decades. And the concept behind that is listening to mothers talk to a nine-month-old or a one-year-old baby. They don't say, sweetheart, would you like to eat breakfast? I mean, it's right. You smile because it's so ridiculous that you would think you would do that. But you do talk to them. And you do probably do something like this. Yummy, yummy, yummy. Look what's so delicious. Look how yellow these sweet potatoes are. They're super yummy. Open your mouth, sweetheart. So when you look at that type of language, there are qualities, there are characteristics that are very specific and that we see in cultures around the world. So there's lots of repetition. There's short phrases. There's a sing-songy quality to it, a musicality to it. An increased volume to it. So there are certain qualities that really typify how we tend to speak to children. I mean, not always. Sometimes we don't have that much energy in our voices. And as they get older, you know, if you do that with a three-year-old, they're going to say, don't talk like that. I'm not a baby, you know, right? But here's the curious thing. All of us, babies, toddlers, and adults, the more upset we get, the less the words mean and the more the way we say the words mean. So for example, if someone, you know, if someone is grieving, your friend is grieving, and you go up to them and you say, Janet, I am so sorry. I can't even believe what that must be like for you. And I mean, and you know what I mean? That the words actually are going to be fine. But the way you said the words, totally, it's worse than removing the value. It actually has a negative value. It makes you want to run away. On the other hand, if you don't say words and you just go, Janet. I mean, that's not very eloquent. If you read that in a book, it wouldn't really make any sense. But in person, it makes a lot of sense. And so it turns out when you look at the brain, we have, you know, a right half and left half of the brain. The left half of the brain deals with language, logic, patience, problem solving, adult type stuff. We call it the executive brain function. The right half of the brain deals with nonverbal language, musicality, bouncing to music, photographic memory or recognizing place and persons, and emotionality, fight or flight reflex. You know, do I got to get out of here? How am I going to respond instantaneously as opposed to analytically? Now, it turns out that the more upset we get, the more we dial down our right brain and dial down our left brain, our executive adult brain, and dial up our right brain. I kind of think of that as going down an evolutionary elevator, becoming more and more primitive the more upset we are. And I don't say primitive in a pejorative way. I just mean kind of basic immediate function. And so we have a term for that actually in our culture. We call it going ape, right? You get more upset you get, you become emotional, unreasonable, non-analytic, and not very verbal, impatient. All of that stuff happens because we're dialing down our left brains. It turns out young children are much more right brain dominant than left brain dominant from the very beginning. And eventually it moves over to the left brain. So for example, when you see little babies grabbing things, they're usually ambidextrous. Oftentimes, a one and a two-year-old may even be left-handed, even though they end up right-handed, because the left hand is controlled by the opposite, by the right half of the brain. And so it turns out that if you say to a nine-month-old, mother is very happy, no freaking clue what you just said, right? But if you go, Totally get it. The baby 1,000% understands that. So they understand language, but they understand nonverbal language much better than the words. And then little by little, the words will, you know, come into play. And so the motherese kind of plays on that, or toddlerese, which is kind of my riff on it, because the goal I wanted people to understand is that the more upset your child gets, and toddlers are famously known for getting upset, the more you have to use this special type of a language, which has three characteristics. That is kind of what I teach in the Happiest Toddler book, which kind of, there's a book and a video that goes into all of this. And there's tons of information on our website also. If anyone wants free information about toddlers, to come to happiestbaby.com. I tried to get happiestbaby.com, wasn't able to, and that didn't work, but happiestbaby.com. Anyway, so the three characteristics of toddlery: short phrases, repetition, and mirroring a third of their emotion in your tone of voice and gesture. And I underscored that third of their emotion because some people, and actually when I wrote The Happiest Toddler the first time, I said that you mirror their emotions. That's incorrect. Bring if you're mirroring, yeah, you gotta be submissive to them. And there's kind of a thing, it's an interesting thing from a sensory point of view when you're dealing with toddlers. If you're trying to support them when they're upset, or you're trying to set limits, which is our job as parents to set limits as well, you will change your height relative to your child. And I'm sure you've done this 1,000 times, where when you need to be the boss, you want to get a little bit above their eye level. Yeah, prop it up, puff out that chest a little bit. And when you want to reassure them or help them through their, yeah, then you're kind of being a little submissive and letting them feel dominant. So short phrases, meaning one or two words, three words, repetition, 4, 5, 6, 8, 10 times sometimes, and mirroring a third of their emotion is the secret. And the more upset they are, the more primitive or basic your language has to get.
It's fun. I also always look at it as like I'm validating them by mirroring in a softer way what they're doing. You know, I'm saying like it's not showing them like you're being outlandish in the way that you're acting. It's saying like, no, I understand you. I recognize you. I feel you. So I also think that like that element of it is helpful for the child also. I've definitely used you know, those tools myself with my children. One, to de-escalate them. You know, when they're having these like really, you know, whether it's anger, whether it's sadness or whatever it might be, to kind of help bring them, you know, back to a place where they feel more regulated, where they can be more in control of how they're responding to things. But I've also found it really helpful for just, and this is something that you talk about too, it's not just for the de-escalation, but it's also just building connection between the child and the parent, you know, saying like, I'm here with you, I'm speaking with you, we're in this together. And it's funny, you had said, you know, as they get older, obviously dependent on the child, it may or may not work. But I think it was so prevalent in my household as like a tool that I'm even able to use it with my kids now that they're a little bit older. And it's not as annoying. It's more like it's the familiarity. It's the comfort of it, too.
It is. And you'll use it with adults as well. When I gave my book to the publisher read it and my editor read it. And she got back to me a few days later and said, oh, my God, this helped me so much with a friend of mine, the relationship I have. So the thing of it is really dialing it up and down and kind of learning to do that, because everybody wants to hear. I mean, for example, your teenager wants, you know, the keys to the car to go to a party, but you had a deal with her. You thought that she was going to clean up the room and other stuff, and then she was going to get to go. So that was the deal, but she didn't do that. And so she comes to you and goes, you know, can I have the car keys? And you go, well, I'd like to give you car keys, but, you know, you didn't clean up your room, so I can't do that. And she said, you're the worst mother in the world. You know how important this is to me, and I've been looking forward to this, and why didn't you remind, blah, blah, blah. And the mother can say, well, listen, it's not my job to run your life. You have to be, you know, you can start there, which is like, I'll be in your face as much as you're being in my face. Or you can use this toddlerese technique and go, I can see how important this is for you. Nothing, nothing would make me feel better than to give you the car keys. I want you to go. I've got things to do. I love you so much, and I want you to have your, you know, this would be so great for you to get to go, and I want you to do that. But I can't, because, you know, that's kind of a theatrical way of doing it, where there's repetition and there's short phrases, but that would work with a teenager, because it's very, like you said, it's very respectful. It's very reflective of their feelings. But this is where problems come in. So for parents where they're with toddlers and they're learning about gentle parenting and things like that, and how are we respectful? The way I like to think about it is that the more upset the child is, the more they're in a jungle. They're lost in the jungle. And you're saying, come to civilization, you know, get pull it together, come back out here, be a member of the family. And so when someone's in the jungle, you can't just speak to them from, you know, 5 miles away. You got to go into the jungle and guide them out. And so it's really important when you use respectful listening or active listening to start. You're not going to end up with, you know, you want it. I know you want it. That's where you're going to start. You're going to end up going, oh, honey, you were so upset. I could see from your face was sad, and your body was, you were making fists because you wanted it right now. You didn't want Sarah to play with your toy. You wanted your toy. You'll get to all of that psychological niceties once they settle down. But when they're freaking out, you gotta, and their left brain is turned off, you have to speak to the right brain, which is available, which is those short phrases and repetition and some of their feelings.
The point of like understanding your child and meeting them where they are. So regardless of your child's temperament, which is something that you speak to a lot also, it's like, understand your child. Are they the person who's going to have this like really big reaction? Okay, you're meeting them a third of the way, versus a child who may get, you know, a little bit more, you know, insular and quiet with it. You can also meet them there. So, you know, you're meeting them where they are at that, you know, third of the volume. But I think attuning to your child, you know, regardless of where they are, you're attuned to like, you know, I kind of look at it as like the frequency, like what station are we on the radio? Let's find it. And now let's kind of dial it down a little bit is how my brain processed, you know.
No, that's a great metaphor, or dancing, you know, but they're leading.
I'm a great dancer. No, but exactly. I think that's like it's so helpful and to recognize like this is something that you could continue to carry through. And like to me, when you're talking about gentle parenting, just like understanding, you know, you're not disciplining through kind of punishing them, but you're disciplining them through understanding them, by teaching them, by working with them. And I think sometimes there's that like misconception of, well, you're not disciplining. It's like, no, I am disciplining. I'm just doing it in a different way where I'm not saying something is good. I'm not saying something is bad. I'm recognizing it as a reaction to how their body is receiving something, and I'm going to support them through this, you know? So like,
that's exactly right. And so as a parent, you have to recognize two different types of struggles, two different types of battles. There are battles you can win and battles you can't win. And you need to be really, really clear. Don't get into battles you can't win. You're not going to stuff that broccoli into your child's mouth if they don't want it. And don't go there, because you're going to lose, and you're going to, you know, create a situation where there's going to be terrible resentment. On the other hand, giving the candy, you can 1,000% win. So you can be loving, caring, empathetic, you know, set a boundary. Exactly.
Yeah. I think, again, I it's kind of the premise by which I lead in parenting. I also, you know, understand I lose it sometimes. You know, I do the best that I can in any given moment with this kind of, you know, in my mind. But I do think something that has always helped me kind of take the edge off of everything is understanding that when they are kind of doing, particularly as a toddler, that attention seeking, as you describe, kind of the right brain's taking over. It's just because they're trying to communicate something. They may not know how to verbalize it. They may not know how to communicate it. They may not be in control of it.
And think about the world from the toddler's point of view. You know, if the baby is really a fetus for the first 6 months, how should we think about toddlers? And so there are kind of two things that I think help parents understand toddlers. One is that just like teenagers are 1 foot in childhood and 1 foot in adulthood, and they're going back and forth and back. Then they have to finally jump into adulthood, hopefully, and become adults. But they struggle back and forth. You know, I hate you. You're so unfair. Can I have the car keys? Right. I mean, that's the, you know, I don't want to clean my room, but I want to, you know, what was there's a book called Get Out of My Life. And while you're on the way, can you drop Cheryl and me off at the mall? So with toddlers, it's between infancy and childhood. I'm a baby. I'm a big boy. I'm a baby. I'm a big boy. And part of what we want to do as parents is to prepare them for being children, responsible, good children. And so part of that, the deal with that is to make them feel good about themselves. So I trust you. I care about you. I like oh, wow, look what you did. You were able to get that little peanut out of the, you know, whatever, you know, to let them know that we, the rock stars of their lives, are observing them and are thinking they're cool. Right. And as we can, we start building their sense of independence by giving them options and kind of allowing them to have some control in the world where it's safe. And, you know, we have no problem giving them those choices. You want the blue cup or the red cup? You know, you want the big spoon or the baby spoon? You don't even like that baby spoon anymore. You love your big... Right. We do these little things that make them feel seen in the world and ultimately build them to feeling successful. And that's why the communication part is so important, because that's how we build an image of ourselves in our own minds is the way we see people react to us. So I want to tell you one other little fun, little easy thing to do, works 1,000% of the time.
What are you going to say? Are we going to talk about gossiping? Are we going to talk about us? there is no greater thing you have done for me and my family than the art of gossiping. And I'm going to let you explain it, but just know that, like, from firsthand experience, Jesse and I utilize this like on the regular, and it's like the most brilliant and simple thing. So you go ahead and explain it. But I knew where we were going, because it's like the most beautiful, simplest thing that you can do that you may not even think of. So
the thing about my work, being a pediatrician, you got 20 minutes to do the exam. The kids got to cooperate. And so I started developing little tricks and skills to get kids to cooperate. And there's a whole bunch of, there's like 20 different ideas in The Happiest Toddler and they kind of like work. It's just understanding their psychology. It's a little like jujitsu, I guess. If you know how to hold someone, you'd be very successful. Anyway, it turns out that people believe more that they overhear than what's told directly to them. That's just a phenomenon of human beings. So for even governments, I mean, if our government reads something in, you know, a foreign newspaper, we go, well, that's interesting, but I don't necessarily believe that. It's probably misinformation or whatever. But if we intercept a secret message that's encoded, that is the hardest code ever in the world to break, that we believe.
Right.
That is the truth. And so it turns out that all of us believe more that we overhear than what's told directly to us. If someone goes, Rachel, you look great today, you go, oh, thank you very much. But you feel they're being polite. But if you hear them in the hall going, Rachel looks great today. Yeah. You're like, don't I look great all the time? Or just, you know? So, but you have more credibility. And so with little kids, it's so easy to say, wow, you picked up your toys super fast. Give me five. Good job. But then 15 minutes later, you pretend you're talking to the birdie outside or grandma on the telephone. And you go in a whisper voice without looking at your child. That's important. Yeah. Bobby, I said, Bobby, pick up your toys. And you know what? Super, super fast. Bobby picked up all his toys. And I said, good job. And Bobby's big ears listening in, you know, and going, I'm hearing that a lot lately from people, not remembering you're the same person who said it twice. Right. And so it's a little manipulative, so don't use it for evil, only for good. But it really reinforces the positive and the negative messages. the criticisms that you might have about hitting your sister or taking her toy or biting or whatever. You can reinforce what your expectations are, positive and negative, through doing this. And like I said, you don't want to be disrespectful about it. So as kids get older, you literally have to be more sneaky.
Yeah.
They all the time they're doing it anyway. Like you're talking in the car and Mr. Big Ears in the back goes, I heard what you said. You know, that thing happens. But if you want to use it as a tool, you start dropping words. So you start saying, yeah, and Bobby, all the toys, good job. And as they get older, they're leaning in and they can put the pieces together. So it is very, very sneaky to do, but it's really helpful.
It was funny. Our kids, we had just come back from being away. There was, you know, things were out of routine, all the things that would like normally dysregulate a child. We understood this. So there was slightly more, less kindness to one another when we first came back. Everyone was kind of like grappling for the attention and everything. And so we saw them. We like sneakily kind of walked into the other room and Jesse and I started doing it. And I was just saying like, oh, you know, I love it when they're being so kind to one another and they're supporting each other. And I'm like, and when Rose is helping Gracie do, you know, whatever it was. Like, and I go into this whole narrative.
Specific. That's so helpful to make it
very specific. And she wakes up the next morning and she is like, I've been doing a really good job of being, and like, she like, it was literally the narration that we had done. And it, the entire day, that was like her agenda for the day. Her agenda for the day was helping to be a supportive sister, to help build, I had been manipulative, but the end game was for good. It wasn't for evil, I promise. And it was really beautiful, but it was so funny. Anytime Jesse and I were like having a hard moment, we'll kind of look at each other and we're like, gossip, 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 you know? And we'll figure out ways. And as you said, you kind of have to be a little bit more clever as they get older with how you're doing it and you know, recognizing that they're growing their intelligence also. And then layered with a lot of the other tools and resources that you provide and tips and tricks and all of those wonderful things. But yeah, gossiping has been incredibly helpful. Toddleries was incredibly helpful. 5S's was incredibly helpful. You know, again, you kind of...
There's playing the boob and there's patient stretching and there's red light, green light, yellow light behavior. There's lots and lots of very, very specific things that literally in a day or two, you can see a response. And that's kind of the fun. Hey, listen, having said that, it's freaking hard raising kids, and especially in our culture and you know, God bless you guys in New York City being able to do that. And but anywhere, it's not easy, and no one was meant to do this on their own, much less if they're single parents. Or so, you know, pat yourselves on the back. All of this conversation is really just to give little tiny bits of help to the incredibly difficult work that our parents are doing every single day. And you know, I know your role, everything you were doing at Good Housekeeping and what you're doing now and what my role is really just trying to be cheerleaders on the side and try to give some little tidbits of wisdom that might be helpful.
No, I appreciate that. A few more things. I know I only have you for a few more minutes, but I did want to kind of bring it to, I was reading, you had recently written an article about outdoor play, and I think just like, it's summertime, we want kids outside. Do you have any advice for parents of how can they can help facilitate getting a child to be interested in wanting to go outside, wanting to engage, wanting to play? You know, they may want to stay inside, watch their TV, watch their show, whatever have you. Do you have any, again, you're so good at giving kind of those like very practical tips and tricks. Do you have like something in your pocket? You could be like, this is a way to help, you know, bring this inside in a way that feels productive for everybody.
Maybe I'll try. Well, so first of all, remember I was saying that I think of babies as being, you know, fetuses outside the uterus. That's the kind of best way I think for parents to understand their job. To understand toddlers, it's important to understand that really toddlers haven't changed in 50,000 years. Toddlers expect to be born, you know, to live in a teepee or a cave and to run outside when daybreak comes and pee on the grass and roll down the hill and smell the wood burning on the fire and watch the run after the dogs and the chickens. I mean, that's kind of toddlers. They're confused. It's like, this is not the world I was expecting.
Right.
Some of them love being indoors and just planting themselves in front of the screens. And but for the most part, they really love motoric play. And while they might be hesitant in the beginning, if you can bring them to a park or a playground where there are other kids, that kind of gets their interest, even for the watchers. You know, some kids who are kind of slow to warm up and they really kind of like to observe for the first few times they go to the playground, it still is teaching them and inspiring them and feeding them with information, even if they're not participating yet. And just tell you one of the fun things I like to do when I go to playgrounds is, if you understand this idea that what I like to say, that toddlers are like cavemen. They haven't changed, you know, like I said, in 100,000 years or so. And when you go to a playground, you see a one-year-old who's like millions of years ago, ancient being, compared to a two-year-old who's like, you know, 100,000 years ago, to like a three-year-old who's like painting their faces and putting feathers in their hair, which is what people did, you know, 30,000 years ago. And you really kind of see all of the levels of human development stacked one next to the other right there in real time in the playground, to the four-year-old who's learning to read letters and the five-year-old who's learning algebra or something, you know. So anyway, the point being that most kids just want to be outside, and having sensory play. So for the kids who aren't big motor players, you know, having a sandbox, having a little bit of a mud, a little mud dish that they can play with, or having hills that they can try rolling down. I mean, getting some experience in that, and engaging with them. I mean, there's a temptation to just be on your phone when they're running around, which is fine. I mean, we love our phones, you know, they're part of our lives. But the kids are constantly looking back to see, did we just see what they did? And that is what makes them feel so special. So you do want to stay engaged during those periods as well.
Yeah, I think, like, again, anytime I show interest in what they're doing, so not that I have to be involved in absolutely everything, but kind of everyone, and I actually think it's for the benefit not to, but saying like, wow, look at that, you know, kind of in the way you describe it.
Yeah, yeah, to give them a little praise. One way, just kind of weaving the home and outdoors together, which I think is super valuable for kids, and is really a sensory opportunity, is dealing with food, cooking, preparing dinner. There are a couple of wonderful books by a friend of mine, Laurie David. One is called The Family Dinner, and the other is called The Family Cooks. And what we know is that families that have meals together, it doesn't have to be every single meal, but if you can have meals together and have an opportunity when the phones are put away and you're just human beings with human beings, has real benefit in terms of academic abilities, you know, reduced sexuality in teenage years, school success. I mean, things that you would never expect are encouraged through those little interactions that we have. And then, of course, you can work together chopping vegetables and washing things and going to the store and picking out what's ripe and not what's not ripe and smelling the fruit and having all sorts of ways to bring the senses and cognition together and social participation. It's one of the great, great things to do. And then you can start planting things outside and grow your own food.
Hey, that's what we've done. And the kids learn the most through doing, I have found, you know, so like, watching us eat and seeing what we're doing, and to the point of no phones. We don't usually have it at the table, and I had it out the other night, and my son was like, "Mom, no phones." And I was like, "Oh yeah, good point," you know, and I put it away, and they pick up on things, you know, just by us doing it and experiencing it alongside us. I want to be
and have a little bowl that every time they catch you doing that or saying a curse word or something like that, yeah, put a dollar in there and then spend that on a fun thing for the family, because then they feel like they have power in the world. Because they have no power, so they just they're begging to have some power to do something, so it allows them to feel like they have agency and they're important people in the world.
I just want to say thank you, thank you, thank you. It has been such a pleasure. What a privilege it is to speak to you, to learn from you, to have you as a friend. And I'm just grateful for you sharing your wisdom with the audience, so that they can have some some takeaways and, you know, empower them. I think that that, you know, for me, it's always been about let's educate to empower parents, because it is hard. It is challenging. It's not the way it's supposed to be. So if we can help them better understand and we can provide resources and tips and strategies and understanding how empowering it is for the parent and then how empowering and helpful and supportive it can be for the child. So thank you for all that you're doing. And it was a pleasure seeing you, and we will speak soon. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Rach.
Thank you, Dr. Karp. It's been a privilege having you on, learning more about everything from the fourth trimester into toddlerhood, into childhood, different tips and strategies that are helpful for understanding your child through the lens of sensory. For more information on sensory play activities and resources, be sure to check out the links in the show notes below, and you can find all the different resources that Dr. Karp pointed out during this episode. And of course, don't forget to like, share, subscribe to this channel, and you can check out our sponsor EduShapes website and social media channels for more insightful conversations on all things toys and child development. Thanks.